now 6 minutes after 8, and we have Representatives Sanders, Hodgins, Ryan, Elton, and James. So we do have a quorum, and we're back on SB 105, where we left off. So if you could go ahead, we have staff for Senator Kelly. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Benjamin Brown from Senator Kelly's office. I believe we were on section...
What
was it? 28? Oh, I always thought we were all the way up to 32.
That's right, Ben. Yeah,
this is page 19 of the committee substitute.
Version L.
Version L, dated the 2nd of April. And is Susie online in Anchorage?
Yes, she is. And before we get going, I would like to bring attention to everybody. We have a new person sitting at the end of the table down here, and welcome Representative Sanders. To be part of our State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay, let's go. You're on 20. Which page is that on?
19 of the committee substitute.
Boy, we really got a long ways, didn't we? Okay.
Almost a third of the way through it the other morning.
Well, I don't know if I'm not finding myself. What is it?
Have you got the CS, the work draft?
Well, I thought I did.
It's the backslash L is the version?
It's disappearing for some reason.
Okay, I have one now.
They're very popular. You really have to keep this happy under lock and key or someone will walk away with it.
Yeah.
Mine's been autographed.
Okay, I'm with you now.
Okay. Section 28 increases the amount in the Legislative Ethics Code of the amount that one can take in a gift annually and clarifies, actually the next section is what clarifies some of the more particular sections. 2460.080A currently has a limit of $100 for annual aggregate gift amount. The Ethics Committee recommended increasing this to $250. They thought $100 wasn't a substantial enough level to toll ethical concerns, and they thought 250 was a better number to go with. And it actually puts into the that during session, it's not legal to take anything from lobbyists except for food and beverage for immediate consumption, which has been that's been what they've been enforcing. This actually puts it in the statute in a real explicit manner. And that's a recommendation from the Ethics Committee, and it's been in the bill since its initiation.
Okay, Representative Elton.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is Susie online?
Yes, she is. She's in Anchorage, Ohio.
Susie, can you hear me?
I can. Good morning.
Good morning, Susie. I mean, this section has raised a question for me, and tomorrow morning, I'm soliciting on behalf of K2 Radio on their fundraising drive. What happens if a lobbyist calls in and donates to K2 tomorrow morning?
I guess we send you to jail within minutes.
I'll second that.
No, it's there is an advisory opinion that came out before you began serving on the Ethics Committee that allows for solicitation for charitable organizations so long as they meet certain conditions, including 501c status or recognized as a local, ongoing charitable organization. And I'd be glad to get that to you, but it's fine for you to do that. You personally could not accept a gift.
Okay, moving right along.
As a matter of fact, we put that exemption in here with the bill, I believe, Susie, that solicitations on behalf of charities is all right.
You're correct, Ben.
Another provision of this wonderful piece of legislation. And that's the way they've been enforcing it. It's the same thing for ski-a-thon or selling raffle tickets or anything like that. So I'm on to Section 29 then. This is some exemptions to the ban on receipt of gifts. Notwithstanding A of this section, it begins, it's not a violation of this section for a legislator or a legislative employee to accept. And this allows you to stay at someone's house and have that be hospitality. The bill would put in a restriction on the exemption that a vacation home outside the state is not considered a residence. So So you can't go to someone's condo in Hawaii and say, oh, I was just staying overnight at their house. That's a gift of value under the code if it's outside the state. And this will permit, this section would also permit, you know, the receipt of discounts if you were traveling, so that you could save the state money, but not be perceived as being unethically gifted, given a gift. And then finally, down on line 17 through 26 of page 20 of the CS, this permits legislative session discounts, emoluments that make living in the capital city more hospitable and pleasant for us. And the best example I can think of it is probably a potential violation under the current code by the letter of the law are those parking permits that we get. Because were those available for sale on the open market, I'm sure the city and borough of Juneau could sell them for quite a bit of money. But they aren't. They're just given one per office. But they really do have quite a substantial value probably in the long run. And it's not technically legal for us to receive those really right now. Because
it is with
this allows for it. This allows for a certain few niceties here and there on behalf of the capital city. So any questions about 29? And that, those are recommendations from the Ethics Committee as well. Section 30, this deals with disclosure of the value of gifts. So the dollar amount has been raised from 100 to 250 for conforming purposes. And the deadline for disclosure of the gift has been brought forward 2 months, substantially, I would say. The idea there being that the earlier the public knows about the receipt of these gifts, the higher public policy is served. If there was a provision originally that these disclosures would be made to APOC in addition to the Ethics Committee, and in order to reduce paperwork and unnecessary red tape, the committee is going to be the recipient of these reports. And then it, in turn, will forward them to APOC so that they're available to the public. The idea there being the Ethics Committee really is not in the business of, other than publishing things in the journal, Susie really isn't in the business of, you know, she doesn't have a web page. I don't believe you have a web page where you publish all our disclosures, do you, Susie?
No, I don't, but we do keep a list available, and when people ask, we provide it.
But APOC, on the other hand, you know, has a real user-friendly format now where most everything that's getting filed with the commission is available on the web, and it's very easy for the public to access the information.
Representative Ryan?
What kind of fiscal note goes along with this bill?
Well, Madam Chairman, to respond to Representative Ryan's question, the fiscal notes have not been revised since the many of the changes were made. The most expensive part of the bill was the ramping up of the Executive Branch Ethics Act and the transference of a lot of the duties from the Department of Law to the Personnel Board. Now that the proposal that we're looking at is not going to transfer anywhere near as much of that responsibility or work, I think the fiscal note will shrink precipitously. The same thing for the APOC fiscal note. Now that we've reduced the number of people in the executive branch who are going to be filing public official disclosure forms, I'm hoping to see that fiscal note shrink. It'll have to, I believe, move out of this committee. And I guess it would be nice if maybe we wanted to start working on those. I mean, you've probably been thinking in terms of that, Mike, in terms of the personnel board one. But we haven't adopted the amendment yet, so it's a little premature to. But to really answer your question, they were quite large. The fiscal note says this bill passed the Senate and came over. It was on the order of $250,000 a year from the personnel board, $70,000 a year from APOC, zeros from law, LAA, and from.
Let law handle it all then.
So there was a tremendous fiscal impact, and a lot of the work that's been done trying to refine the bill has had the idea of not creating unnecessary costs in mind behind it.
Okay, moving on.
Okay, then. Section 31, this specifies, this is actually what Susie calls the low-budget campaign section of the bill, and it specifies that a small amount of a contribution that has to be reported under the Campaign Finance Act doesn't have to be considered a gift under this section. Susie, can you speak to that a little better?
If Brooke Miles is there, she could speak to this better, because this is actually, these low-budget campaigns were created in campaign finance reform, but what this change is saying that you know, we've always said, and the law is clear in stating that contributions to campaigns are not gifts. And this further clarifies that given that change in campaign finance reform and the creation of these little low-budget campaigns, still contributions to those are still not gifts.
I think you just stated that...
What is the limit on the new change that we had?
$2,500.
It used to be 1,000 and now it's 2,500. So if you have a campaign less than 2,500, you don't have to consider those as gifts.
Right, and they're also exempt from the standard reporting under the Campaign Finance Act. So we have to cite both types of...
So you can get $2,500 and not tell anybody where you got it.
and mount a media blitz with it.
Does that include municipal campaigns?
Yes, it does.
Okay, going on.
Section 32. This is an exemption in the gift restrictions that deals with the receipt of gifts from foreign governments or other governmental entities, and we've defined this to include other states, local governments, and foreign governments. And this is to allow the receipt of gifts for protocol purposes by legislators if you go to a council state governments meeting, or even if somebody from the city of Kenai comes and wants to give you something, as long as you receive it in a public-spirited context on behalf of the legislature, this exempts your receipt of it.
Do that with a parking pass.
I don't know if those are, or if those are perceived as being received on behalf of the legislature.
Well, the government, that's for darn sure.
Okay, moving on.
Moving on to Section 33. This redefines what we call family members for the purposes of the Legislative Ethics Code. And it adds the second phrase, immediate family or family member, includes the spousal equivalent, children, parents, siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and the same group of persons for the spouse. This is, I guess, judged by the Ethics Committee to be the right reach in terms of family membership. You can't go too far. You want to make sure you go far enough. And there's a preferential. It's better to state it this way. We haven't had the problem in our code of speaking of the second degree of consanguinity. We've always listed who the people are, so it's really easy to know. That's a change we actually make later in the bill to the Executive Branch Act, though.
So. Madam Chairman, when can we start
making
amendments to delete some of this stuff?
Whenever we get through going through it.
Thank you.
I would suggest, and on that point, we do have, we'll go through the rest of the bill so everyone's familiar with what's in the bill. We do have a list of amendments that we'll go through, and I would, if as you're going along you want to make some amendments, I would hope that you would come and have your amendments made in writing, and we'll deal with them in order how they go. Representative Berkowitz is here.
Delete.
Go ahead.
Okay. All of the above.
Section 34. And this is where we get to the question you asked earlier, Representative Elton. This adds 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 new subsections, 5 new subsections, excuse me, to the gift portion of the statute, the first of which, H, allows receipt of gifts, solicitation, acceptance, and receipt of gifts on behalf of recognized non-political charitable organizations. In I, it deals with the receipt of the inheritances and makes the disclosures subject to a different standard of confidentiality upon receipt by the committee. J deals with...
Yes, Representative Berkowitz.
Why is this in here?
Susie, why is that in there?
Hold on just a second. Okay. I'm just looking through it.
Section I is what we're looking at.
This is at a request of Senator Pierce, who in, I believe, Senate Finance felt that inheritance, that there was no way to deal with inheritance at the moment under the Ethics Code, and that there should be a way to disclose it confidentially and handle it.
Well, go ahead, Representative Berkowitz.
It seems to me that if I inherit something and I get property out of it, it goes on my financial disclosure forms.
And, Susie, to be fair, I've heard the concern raised that it's hard for a dead person to buy very much influence.
I I don't think that the committee itself is wedded to this particular section. It was just a proposal on the sender's part to, as a way to deal with an inheritance.
Okay.
Yeah, fine. I
that may get revisited. J, if we can go on to J, then this deals with the gift of volunteer services to a legislator. It specifically allows university interns and Job Training Partnership Act gifts of volunteer services. It would not permit BP to pay for an extra staffer in your office, though, and that's the idea here, is it prevents compensation of volunteers, making them not really volunteers, basically, in your office.
Madam
Representative Hodges?
Chairman, would that include the University of Alaska supplying an intern?
No, this specifically allows internships, interns from the University of Alaska, and the Job Training Partnership Act, which are the two categories of interns we currently have working in the building today.
Thank you.
Kay puts in the...
Yes, Representative Ryan.
This last on line 7, that's a hook. Subsection does not permit a legislator or legislative employee to accept a gift of service for non-legislative purpose. There goes your campaign help out the window.
Well, Madam Chairman, to respond, because that language is only there in reference to the subsection, I don't think it has that sort of a far-reaching effect.
That's a pretty outright statement. Let me just think about this. A gift of services for non-legislative purposes.
There's another problem too, Madam Chair.
What is it, Representative Berkowitz?
If we're running a business and someone wants to come do an internship in the business, that's a gift of services, not just for the campaign.
I hear you. That's kind of what I was thinking, because I was thinking that a gift of services for non-legislative purposes, and I'm thinking about all of us who are in business while we're working as a legislator, and particularly when we're in the interim, even more so. And even though my business is very small, there are some people who have larger businesses than me, and I think that... Quite frankly, I have a lot of problem with that when it's for non-legislative purposes, because I thought that we had a little back further here that says that we can accept gifts for non-legislative purposes. I think we just went by that one.
Madam Chairman, this question has been raised several times, and I asked the drafter. Because the reference in that sentence that we're questioning here refers to the subsection, I don't think it in any possible way undoes your right to accept gifts under any other part of the statute. It's merely an attempt to prevent the language here from enabling you to have BP pay for a maid come clean your house and use subsection J as a defense of that arrangement, according to the drafter.
Madam Chairman?
Representative Ryan.
If I may point out, nobody anticipated that putting a sign up would be a political contribution. Nobody anticipated that women coming to a political luncheon would count as part of the total amount of money that a party could raise. We have some organizations who we've let loose who don't show common sense, and I'll be darned if I want to give them another reason to make a stupid interpretation of the law. So I think I'm going to move when the time comes to solve this problem early on. We'll just delete this phony and go on.
Let's go back to that other place. We just went by it this morning.
Well, Susie, maybe you'd like to chime in here. Receipts of gifts for non-legislative purposes are allowed under the code. And what's your sense on this? Do you think that deleting the last sentence of subsection J would damage the new statute?
First, let me clarify that gifts are gifts, and you just have to figure out how they apply. I think that Representative James and Representative Berkowitz have a legitimate question. If you are receiving a gift, regardless in which capacity or part of your life, with a value in this bill of over $250, then you need to figure out, is it, how it fits into the gift code. In this section, I believe that you don't need to worry about this last line because, it clearly says, it refers to this subsection, and it's saying to you that, you know, it's only talking about volunteer services and trainee services. In the larger capacity, and the question about campaigns that Representative Ryan asked, I believe that Brooke Miles could speak to, because there are definitions of that in the code, and our ethics code exempts those. You don't have to worry about volunteer time in your campaigns. A volunteer to your business, an intern to your business, I've never asked, or I've never addressed that question before. But I honestly don't feel the code applies to it. I can work on that question and get back to you.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Hodges?
I believe it does speak to that, and I believe that it is. I would be in violation if somebody came into my post office, which I am a contractor for, and worked at that. If my sister came in, or my nephew, or my niece, who I do employ, if they came in and volunteered an hour or two to help get mail up, I would be in violation of that with this subsection in here. Well, actually,
family is the...
Yeah, that would be a gift from family.
Family doesn't count, but if it was your neighbor or a good friend, then it would be a violation, I believe, under this. And so I have a real problem with that. I wanted to ask one question based on this, if I could, and see if I understand this correctly. As I understand it, you can take gifts. Is it that you cannot take a gift over $250 worth, or is it if you do, you have to dispose it?
Representative James, are you asking me the question? I'm not sure.
Yes, I am, Susie.
Generally, that's the line. Let's say that this bill passes. You've got a $250 line. Anything below that is an acceptable gift, regardless of who it's from.
And do we have to report it?
No, there's not a reporting requirement. At the point at which you hit the $250 mark, or today, at the point at which you hit the $100 mark, then you have to start asking yourself questions, and you have to say, does this gift fit into any of the exceptions? If it fits into any of the exceptions, if it's a gift of travel and hospitality for the purposes of obtaining information on legislative matters, if you go up to the slope and take a visit there, then you can say, oh, okay, the trip costs $500, but yes, I may accept it. This is one I have to disclose because I see it's listed in the exceptions. Oh, I got this crystal vase from my Aunt Jean. Oh, I can accept that because that's from a family member. So then that's at the point you begin looking. If it doesn't fit into any of the exceptions, then you have to return the gift.
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Representative Hodges?
Let me give you this case then. I'm the contractor for the Nikiski Post Office, and I have an agreement with a school, not the University of Alaska, allow kids to come in under their vocational education program, mm-hmm. and they work for less dollars than the normal employee. The rate that they work for that's less than the normal employee, is that a gift? Susie?
I'm here. I'm always concerned about answering these questions just right on the spot, because with our informal advice, I usually try and take a minute and look through the law, and so we end up in these meetings with playing stump the staff, and I'm always concerned later, oh, if I gave a quick answer. I would say that that's not a gift. You are having an exchange in value. You're paying for their services. It may be at a discounted rate, but that is a business, a contractual agreement between you and your business, and does not fall within the gift section here. That would be my informal advice. It's not binding on the committee.
Well, let's see if I can stump the committee one more time. BP has a cleaning person come in and you pay him a buck.
Representative Hodges, I'm quite sure at that point that you would declare that to be a gift.
But what's the difference? An employee is an employee.
But who's paying him, BP or you?
Right.
The school pays the employee, the student. So if...
But you're providing a vocational, educational experience. And actually, the committee in cases like this has had this question posed to them, and the committee's able to say, yeah, in fact, the JTPA partnership, or the trainees, someone came and said, look, you know, JTPA pays for a trainee. May we accept it? And the committee looked at the situation and said yes. So I think it's more of a case like that if you wanted to go through.
So Representative Ryan is right. The more that we make this gray, the more fun you guys have.
That definition of fun is a big one, isn't it?
Well,
okay, let's go on. I have a real problem with this, but we'll think about that afterwards.
And, you know, I actually asked the drafter if we took the last line out, if the statute would still work, and she thought that it would, but she, again, because of the reference to the subsection only, didn't think it was that onerous. Okay, on to K, then, line 9 of page 23 of the House Committee Substitutes. This places a requirement on those covered by the code, legislators and legislative employees, that the receipt of a gift by a family member that is based upon that family member's connection to you as a legislator or legislative employee requires disclosure under the code as if you had received the gift. And that's merely to prevent the spouses of legislators from being bought lavish gifts as a means of going through a loophole in the code. And finally...
Wait. I have to digest this one.
Okay.
A legislator or legislative employee who knows or reasonably should know that a family member has received a gift because of the family member's connection with the legislator or legislative employee shall report the receipt of the gift by the family member to the committee. Give me an example. Who is this something that came from the committee? And if so, could they give me an example of this?
I'm going to guess that you're looking at me again, Representative James.
Yeah. But Susie.
Gifts of travel for matters of legislative concern given to allow your spouse to travel with the legislator would have to be reported. The same would hold true for gifts that legislators or legislative employees would be prohibited from accepting that are received by family members. So a gift of over 250 given to the spouse of a legislator primarily because of the connection to the legislator would have to be reported.
Oh, I get it. Okay, we can move on.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ivan is here. Representative Ryan, any questions?
Who makes the determination that the gift was given because of the person's relationship with the legislator or legislative employee?
Your opponent in the campaign.
Yeah, your opponent in the campaign, the newspaper reporter.
For you. You know, as the reporter, you would have the option of making that determination as well.
Yeah.
And
it's a perception of, it's a perception. If you believe that it looks like that was because, in other words, that person wouldn't have gotten that gift if it hadn't have been for you being a legislator or a legislative employee, then that makes sense to me. Let's go on.
Subsection L, this merely empowers the committee to... And mandates that the committee use fair market value as a standard. So, again, trying to prevent the loopholes, saying, I thought the crystal vase was worth $12.50. That's not something that the committee wants people to feel like they have leeway to do. So the committee's going to go ahead and you have the fair market value standard as its means of ascertaining the value of gifts covered by the code.
Oh, dear. Okay.
And this is that's a questionable standard because there's replacement costs, and we discussed this in subcommittee a little.
I understand. We have talked about this before, and there's also depends on where the gift came from and how much they paid for it. And the problem with fair market value is how much is anybody willing to pay. And so if someone got a good deal and bought you a simple little gift and didn't pay very much for it, but the gift was very valuable, then you may not be able to accept it. That doesn't seem reasonable to me. because there are all different prices. You can pick them up at a garage sale, as an example. But if it's worth a lot more than what you paid, then all of a sudden what to the gift to you is how much the value. If I was watching on television last night where they were looking at antiques and so forth, and some of these things people had picked up at a garage sale for $20, it's now worth $6,000 or $7,000, and they didn't have a clue what they had.
Thank God they weren't legislators.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know,
obviously we're up
in common law, the intent drives the system. In this case, perception drives the system. I have a problem with that, but let's go on.
Well, just for the benefit of the full committee, when we looked at the fair market value issue in subcommittee, it was in the context of adding a reference to it to the Executive Branch Ethics Act, and at the recommendation of Mr. Slotnick from the Department of Law, we took that out of the Executive Branch Ethics Act. And this is a recommendation from the Ethics Committee. They're trying to ask, they're again asking the legislature for clarity, you know, to clarify their mandate. And without the mandate, then they don't have to use fair market value as a standard. They can.
Okay, let me tell you what my belief is that unless there is a complaint out there that the value that's ascertained on the report from the legislature, that I don't believe that the Ethics Committee on their own should not accept the value that's placed on it by the legislator or the person who's reporting. If the complaint is that they have this very, very valuable thing, then they might have to respond to the complaint. But it seems to me like that the best thing for legislators to do is to, in their own records, determine where they got the value.
Representative James, excuse me for interrupting, but that's exactly the way it works. And this was included by the committee just as because the question is asked of the committee on a regular basis, what value do I put on it? But you have explained exactly the way life works with the committee.
Okay, so why do we have to put it in here?
It would be, it was added as a guidance for people so that they don't have to call the offices often and say, what should we do? And our answer is always, well, the logical response is go for fair market value.
Okay. I had some things that it wasn't things so much as other things when I was in China. And you know, it's 8-1 in American money. And if I were to use Chinese money as opposed to American money, it made a big difference. And or what I could purchase it for in this country when I was buying some things. And so I had a real struggle with that, but it seemed to me like if I related it to how much money it would have cost me to buy it, that was the rational way to do that. Now, that's not necessarily, the fair market value here. It's what could I buy it for in American money there, you know, so someone could say, well, that was a lot more valuable here, and maybe it was. In many cases, it might be the other way. I have fair market value is a fine way to do it, but it seems to me like cost is better. So anyway, go ahead.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hutch.
Who came up with this CS?
This CS is a result of the subcommittee that worked for about, I don't know how many weeks we worked on this.
This was
in public, in this room, with everyone knowing that we were here.
Berkowitz and who else?
And Representative Ivan was the subcommittee.
So you guys came up with this?
No.
We reviewed it.
And we reviewed it. The amendments were brought to us from Senator Kelly's office, and we went through the issues. We had a bill that was brought to us from the Senate, and to that bill there were suggested changes.
30 pages
of suggested changes, and we walked ourselves through these changes and agreed that some of them should be put into the CS and that some of them should not because they were too controversial. What we ended up with is a CS, which we are currently going through, and when we're through doing this, we will go through those suggested amendments that we have here and any other amendments that this committee wants to address. That's the process.
60 pages.
And most of the stuff we've been going through today, all of the stuff we've been going through today in 2460 has been in the bill. All since the beginning of last year when it was introduced at the committee's request, and it was also in Senate Bill 141 in the 19th legislature. So most of this ethics committee stuff has been around longer than any other provision of the bill. These are changes the committee has been seeking for years and years and years now.
That certainly gives me a lot of comfort.
But obviously none of it's written in stone. And
I understand how frustrating this bill is. It's as frustrating to me as anyone else. But I really want to get through this, and I really want to get done, and I really want to get this bill out of this committee. So as much as we can improve the process, I would appreciate the help that I can get on that. And take note, and if there are things in here you want to take out, certainly there will be a time when we will address the amendments, one at a time. Representative Ryan.
Well, Madam Chairman, 4 years ago this committee was characterized as being the black hole into which legislation went and never saw the light of day. I don't know what your intention is of how you want to run your committee, but I suggest for the purpose of this bill that this committee take on those characteristics again, and this would be a very good place for this bill to die.
All right. Representative Ryan, you might feel that would be a benefit to do that. There are extenuating circumstances that indicate that's not true. Representative Elton?
Well, just a brief comment, Madam Chair. I mean, I think we're mixing up where the real problem may be. I mean, I think some people have a philosophical problem with the Ethics Committee and the statutes that govern it now. And I view this piece of legislation as an opportunity to make it better. I mean, there are some things, if this bill doesn't go, that aren't going to get better and that are going to contribute to a continuing grayness that is out there that the Ethics Committee has to deal with all the time. So to the extent that we look at this bill as a way to improve it, and to the extent that we revise this bill so that the improvements we're comfortable with, I think that is a good committee function. I mean, if we do nothing and if this bill goes into the black hole, I mean, one of the results of that is that some of those areas of grayness that are out there will remain out there, and some of those things that were put into law a decade ago, for example, the gift limits of $100 rather than $250, will not change.
Okay, let's go on.
All right, thank you. Section 35, this is another recommendation of the committee. Existing language in the Ethics Code prohibits acceptance of compensation for personal services that are not commensurate with the services, what's usually paid for that. And that's meant to prevent a professional, for instance, from receiving a $50,000 contract for not doing any work from a company that has an interest in state business and legislative business. The problem with that language about not commensurate with is it prohibits pro bono work. That means you can't do a job and get a lot less than the market value for it when the intention was to prevent you from getting overcompensated. This merely changes the language so it says it's significantly greater than the value of, which allows you to donate your time and services to other causes and not violate the code for not getting paid enough for it.
Value in this context is fair market value?
I don't think there's a standard here because this deals with giving the services, not receiving them. So, Susie, I don't know what the committee's take on that would be.
So if you were an attorney who charged $200 an hour and you said, I'll do it for $1 an hour, it's that difference is what we're talking about.
Well, I was thinking more of the case where you have a non-refundable payment to an attorney, say $2,500 to do a DWI, and when you know what you're doing and if the cards break right, you can get those cases done in a couple of hours. If they don't break right, you wind up working for significantly less of an hourly.
And this would enable you to do that, basically. But
no, that's the problem is if I can get this case done in 2 hours based on the people I know, my intimate knowledge of the law, the circumstances of the case, and it's a question, you know, whether I need to return it some of the money anyway, but I would be precluded by this Ethics Act from taking that $2,500. Now,
Representative Berkowitz, I read that differently, and that is because, and I don't mean to offend you, but unless you are the most incredible attorney in the state, there are probably maybe perhaps 10 other attorneys who are as capable of doing that exact same scenario, and therefore all of a sudden, in your profession, you are commensurate.
Well, if I might, Susie, in my profession, I give people monthly rates all the time, and that's unusual in my business. Most of the people in my business do everything by the hour. And so sometimes, you know, sometimes I spend a lot of time on something and I don't get as much as I should. But many times I make more than I would if I charged by the hour.
And I think on a common sense, logical basis, there would be no question. Because, again, unless you are out of the range, out of the normal range, no one, including the ethics committee, is going to question it. They haven't so far in the last 4 years, or however long this language may have been in, long before the new ethics rewrite. This change allows you to charge less. So we're not even dealing with the really that issue. It's all whether you're in the range of your profession.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ryan.
Chairman, I don't mind anyone else setting the price or the value of what they think their services are worth, but I object vehemently to someone trying to tell me what mine are worth. I have in the past worked as an expert witness in the field of aviation, and this is one of the few times I like attorneys, because I can bill those attorneys for anything I choose, and they just pass it on. And I have made some very, very good money as an expert witness. And I plan on doing this in the future. And I don't want to have to sit around and have some bunch of people who I don't know tell me what they think my expertise as an expert witness is worth and what a fair market value or what some other guy down the road got paid or anything else. In this world and in America, thank God, it's all the traffic will bear plus 10% and blame it on shipping from Seattle. And that's an old Alaska tradition. I plan on following through with it. I'm going to get every penny I can get my hands on.
All right, let's go on.
God, I can't believe this. Can't believe it.
All right, then Section 36 of the bill, this deals with representation by legislators and then the unlikely eventuality, legislative employees who, in the course of employment, represent someone else for compensation before a state agency or board. And this requires disclosure of that representation. If you're an attorney and you take a client before the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board and you're a legislator, the committee want you to disclose that.
And
Representative Berkowitz.
I would hope Representative Hodgins writes this down. Representative Berkowitz, to make it easier for you, I'm writing down the sections we're going to keep.
Okay.
This bill will be a lot smaller.
I understand the concerns here. But I've got to tell you, it is very difficult as an attorney or as a doctor or as a CPA when you have clients and you've got to disclose the names of those clients simply because I personally chose to get involved in the public eye. Now, the parts of my life that are in the public eye should be and are subject to public scrutiny, but when people hire my services in a private context, they're entitled to some privacy protections. And if they're not, then my business as a citizen legislator suffers. So I don't like having to disclose the names of my clients.
And, Madam Chairman, I did speak with a representative of the staff person from the Public Offices Commission after that concern was raised at our last meeting. And I'd be happy to work with you to come up with some sort of language that, you know, strikes the best possible happy medium between the disclosure requirements, so that your sources of income are still, you know, being disclosed, but that your clients' names aren't being disclosed unnecessarily. Because it's something the commission's dealt with on a case-by-case basis, is my understanding. When asked, you know, why do I have to tell you this? Why do I have to tell you this? Right now, the statutory language they have governing their activity doesn't give them as much leeway as they would probably like to deal with professional situations like yours.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Susie?
Just to let you know, we're one of the few states that allows their legislators to represent clients in front of state agencies. So one of the ways to deal with it could be to eliminate that possibility altogether. Then there would be no disclosure requirement.
Representative Ryan?
I suggest that we just repeal the disclosure requirement and be done with it.
Let's go on.
All right, Section 37 of the bill. This adds a new section to the ethics code that deals with a disclosure of this host of information by the 15th of February, which is a new earlier deadline. And it goes through and relists the different sorts of disclosures, which are, you know, currently being made under the statute, except for lobbying. And those begin on line 21 of page 24 of the proposed House committee substitute, board membership, interest in contracts or leases, participation in state loan programs, close economic associations, the inheritance provision 080I, and then the problematic one for Representative Berkowitz on line 1 of page 25, representation of a client under 2460-100. And this is meant to neatly gather together in one section of the ethics code the timing and the subject matter of all the disclosures that are required. Most of which, as I said, are already required by the ethics statute, and we're already turning them in. Okay, section 38 of the bill. This specifies that the public members of the ethics committee don't get compensated, but do get per diem and travel. They're already getting per diem and travel. This puts into statute the current practice. But they're not getting paid for their services. They're just getting the travel and food expenses.
Okay, go on.
Section 39.
Wait a minute. I may.
Yes.
Go ahead. We're talking about contracting for professional and services and employ staff as it considers necessary. There goes the fiscal note.
Representative Ryan, that's already an existing law. Dark underlined is what we're adding to this, and that is the fact that the public members of the committee are entitled to per diem and travel expenses on the board and as for other boards and commissions. All the rest of this, from line 3 to line 11, is an existing law. It's been there for ever since it started.
I understand, Madam Chairman, but it's brought back in front of this bill that puts it on the table.
But it doesn't have a fiscal note because it's not new. What we're doing here, it's a fiscal expense that we are already having.
That's correct, Madam Chairman. It's already part of the budget.
If I may, and then I'll
let it go.
Anytime that you allow a committee or a board or anybody else to employ staff and contractor services as they consider necessary, you've taken the lid off fiscal responsibility, and occupational licensing is a prime example of that.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Section 39 of the bill deals with alternates on the Ethics Committee. It's a bit of an oversight in the current code. Right now, there are just members to the committees, two from the House, two from the Senate, appointed by the presiding officer and confirmed by everyone else, or two-thirds of the membership of the rest of the House. But if a member of the committee with a subject of a complaint or a staff person to a member of the committee, the presiding officer would have to appoint an alternate, and it would be really quite obvious at that point, and the confidentiality of the process would have been breached pretty effectively. So the approach here is to, under Section 40 is tied in, have the president and the speaker go ahead and appoint alternates for each regular member, so that in the case of a complaint against a regular member or a regular member staff person, there's a more seamless transition to the alternate ethics committee member, so it doesn't waving a red flag. We've got a complaint.
So I understand it. The Speaker of the House or the President shall appoint. It doesn't say the Speaker and the Minority Leader. It just says this is just one person, one party. And I come from a background that worries about the appearances of impropriety.
If I might, on that, Representative Berkowitz, I would assume that what this means, and we'll have to ask for legal advice if it does, if it needs to say it, but if you're going to have an alternate, you've got to have two in the House and two in the Senate, because there is two in the House and two in the Senate. And if you're going to have this alternate for this purpose, then you have to have an alternate for the one that they're replacing.
Right. And I think
so that would mean there would be two alternates in the House and in the Senate, one a majority and one a minority member, to replace those if there was some reason why that the original appointee would not be able to act because of a conflict.
So these are standing alternates, then?
Yes.
They're standing alternates.
Yes. It's designed so it's built into the system, so when the need for an alternate member arises, that alternate can just go right into that position. On line 6 of page 26, an alternate must have the same qualifications as the regular member from whom the alternate stands as alternate, well, and is subject to confirmation as required for the regular member.
It would seem to me there should be at least some random quality to which of the alternates get selected, and I don't think the speaker or the president needs to be involved. You could number the alternates 1, 2, 3, 4, and just rotate through them, and that way it's random.
Representative Berkowitz, it's been our experience over the last 4 years, it's really hard to find somebody willing to do this. So I don't know that there's a very broad amount of people who want to be on this committee. I mean, we're really lucky we can find somebody who's willing to do it. It's not a coveted position.
And as far as governing the partisan composition, if you go back to 130, it defines minority organizational caucus. I mean, it's very specific about the partisan representation, so you have people from both sides of the aisle.
No, I'm not worried about the composition of the committee as a whole. I'm worried about, I mean, initially, and that concern was alleviated, was this alternate. I thought maybe the speaker would just reach out in the public and grab somebody, but that's
apparently
not the case.
No, it's
human
legislature.
But the speaker does have a pool of alternates to draw on.
Only at the beginning of the session when appointing the other members, though. So this is long in advance of whatever the complaint is.
Right. But say, for example, one of the members of the committee is precluded from serving. Then the speaker looks at the pool of alternates and says, you will be the one who serves.
No. You're appointed to a seat. She's appointed as your alternate. You can't serve. She automatically serves. There's no discretion. She is the alternate for your seat. It's an automatic thing. It's meant to avoid the selection of someone based on something other than...
Let me try. Representative Berkowitz, the way it's set up right now, we have a minority and two minorities, one from the House and Senate,
mm-hmm.
two majorities, one from the House and Senate. What we're having to deal with here is if one of those people, either the minority or the majority from the House or Senate, happens to be directly involved with a complaint, such as the complaint is against them or one of their staff, then they should have someone to take their place.
Okay.
The person who takes their place should have the same qualifications as they. If they're a minority person from the Senate, it should be another minority person from the Senate to take that person's place. So it's an alternate for that person, not an alternate that does anything else except replace the person that is of the same character as they are.
And I understand that. That makes perfect sense to me. I just don't understand why the speaker or the president's involved in this process.
Because in the original law, that's how the appointment gets made of the legislators. And usually it's done, and since you've been here that long, it's done by finding somebody who's willing and then and I assume I'm not in the minority caucus, so I don't know how that works, but I'm sure that it works the same way. And then, you know, when we're discussing who is willing to do it, are you willing to have them do it? And then, you know, we usually say, well, yes, we're willing to have them do it because no one else wants to do it. And so then they get appointed by the speaker after it's already been run by the caucus, and the minority caucus has that same opportunity to run it by the caucus to see if that person that the minority leader tells the speaker to be done. It goes through the minority leader in all cases. The minority selects who they want to be in there.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And there's a two-thirds concurrence. I mean, you vote, unlike almost any other committee, you're voting to confirm your fellow member as a member of the Ethics Committee. You're a majority member, and the majority members are voting to confirm the minority members of the committee. Two-thirds. I mean, it's a pretty high standard for membership. It hasn't been a problem since the initial empanelment. However, if you'll remember when the first committee was empaneled back in 93, it did take a while. There were names brought forward that were not satisfactory to the body.
I remember that very well.
So, and the irony there is exactly the one you spoke to. This is a hard job, and, I mean, a lot of people really don't want to add it to their workload anyway.
Even in the public members, it's very difficult to find somebody who's willing to do this. Okay, go ahead.
So, that's alternate. That's sections 39 and 40. Section 41, this deals with participation in the political process by the Ethics Committee members, and
the staff, and also probably more significantly contractors to the committee. There had been some questions in prior cases before the committee about partisan involvement by people who had been hired as investigators and hearing officers, if I'm not mistaken, Susie, and this puts language in that really specifies that they needed to adhere to the highest level of apoliticism, well, much like the standards that apply to the members of the Public Officers Commission. And they just can't be out there raising money, having fundraisers, attending fundraisers, to the extent that we can limit their behavior. Any more on that, Susie?
Well, I have a question. I just wrote from this statement. It says they can't do these things. Do they also have to report to the Ethics Committee?
We require a certain amount of disclosure by the public members. What's the disclosure requirement for the contractors, Susie?
The contractors, for example, if we hire a firm to do an investigation and three of them are involved in the investigation, not all 20 employees, if the other 17 never touch anything, then no, those employees of the contracting firm are not involved. But those three, yes, are required to act as employees and disclosure requirements during their term of actual employment. This section really is, you're focusing on the ethics committee members, and yes, they are required to disclose matters, and you've seen disclosures from them in the past. When Joe Donahue's wife, Helen, used to work for the legislature, they both would disclose that economic association. Is that answer?
Yes. Okay, go on.
Okay, Section 42, this actually deals with the contracting with firms again. It enables the firm with whom the committee's contracted, with which the committee's contracted, to request that some of its employees be exempted from compliance with the provisions of the code. And this is so if the committee uses a large law firm that has a Washington office or Seattle office, we're not attempting to loop in everyone who works at those far-flung offices under the provisions of the code. But the good thing about the way this is written is the corporation or partnership, and it's probably going to be a law firm, has to request from the committee that a certain number of its employees be exempted. So the onus is on them to say, we don't think we should all have to abide by this code. And then it gives the committee the ability to exempt them, which it doesn't technically have right now.
Go on.
Section 43, in advisory opinions, this expands the time frame in which the ethics committee can, and also the pool of persons to whom it can respond, requesting advisory opinions. This enables them to answer questions for newly elected legislators or persons who are going to be coming on board as legislative staff further out before the actual period of service as a legislator or work as a legislative employee begins. And also, this specifies that the advisory opinions have always been binding. You know, that's the way we do our code. It's similar to the executive branch request for an opinion from one's designated supervisor. We call and say, I need an advisory opinion. And then once they meet and actually issue one, as long as you do what you said you were going to do in the advisory opinion, you are covered. That really does protect you. This specifies at the end of the section on the top of page 28 that just because you asked for an advisory opinion, you don't have the right to go into executive session when they're deliberating about it. And the committee doesn't feel, I think, that it can be candid in determining advice if legislators or employees have the right to demand that they be in the room while they're deliberating.
And Berkowitz?
Does this authorize the person requesting an advisory opinion to instruct the committee to go beyond 60 days? For example, could I ask for an opinion and say, but I don't want it for another 3 months?
I don't really see that it does provide that latitude. The way I read it, it says the committee shall issue an advisory opinion within 60 days.
If I may interject here, then
go ahead, Susie.
The practice currently, and we've asked about this, and the law doesn't seem to preclude it, that if we write a letter back to the requester saying we will not be able to hold a meeting for 65 days, would you waive that 60-day requirement? That, and if the requester says yes, then the committee is empowered to do that because it's the requester who needs the information and who needs that, who perhaps needs it on a shorter timeline.
What if they say no?
Then we will probably have to hold a teleconference and get on it I mean, we would have to. There'd be no question.
Okay, thanks.
And actually, I'm just reading at the end of that section, the 60-day period for issuing an opinion may be extended by the committee if the person requesting the opinion consents. So the committee does have that express statutory authority. All right, then on to section 44, at the top of page 28. This deals with the issue of complaints that are not resolved but go away due to the resignation or termination of someone's public service or employment. That created a loophole. It would be possible to quit your job and come back, and the committee's jurisdiction over you would have expired with your employment. This, and the same thing, this deals with the situation of a legislator who is the subject of an ethics complaint coming back and working as a staffer, which we've had in the past few years. And if that person, and in that case, the person had not complied with the provisions of a dismissal of a complaint against him by the committee, but the committee, there's nothing the committee could do.
So a legislator subject of an investigation could resign and then be exempted and then run again?
Under the provisions of proposed section 44, the committee would be able within 5 years to bring the charges back up as soon as that person were again covered by the code. Similarly, if a legislator quit, was out of office, and got out of being prosecuted, if you will, on an ethics charge, but then decided, oh, I'll come back and work for my friend as an aide, the committee would be able to say, well, now that you're covered by the code again, and it's been 5 years, we're going to resurrect the charges.
Let me ask you a question. What if they leave the legislature and they go to work for the administration?
Then they would be covered by a different ethics act, and that is not an eventuality that we have dealt with under the provisions of this bill. We don't have any cross-referencing between executive branch ethics and legislative ethics, and it's a very good question, Representative James, because that's really at the heart of a lot of...
Well, maybe we should put that in the administrative ethics part.
Well, it seems to me that it's a valid concern because a lot of the impetus of to improve their act and ramp up their act was the lack of parity between our branch and their branch and the political reality that many people do go from positions in legislative offices to positions in the administration and back and forth. And to have no confluence of legal authority, it opens the potential for loopholes that exist right now between being a legislator and coming back and working as a staffer.
You may think about that.
I mean, it may not
both
be
directions. If there's someone that has an unresolved ethics problem in the administration, leaving and coming to work for the legislature, or vice versa, we don't have to deal with it now. But think about that when we get to the other part of amending this bill, whether or not that we need to do something on that. Let's go on.
All right, then on to section 45, and then it puts the five-year statute of limitations in, and 44. Section 45 deals with the procedures for complaints. Right now, there is a very loose standard to which complainants are held when they make their allegations. And this formalizes the process a little bit more, so complainants know that they have to state that they have reason to believe that a violation occurred, and they have to put the facts that they believe that in there. It's not a tremendously higher standard, but it is a little better than he's guilty and not having to say anything else. And the other beneficial component of this subsection as amended is that the committee will tell complainants as they come in that it'll pretty much warn them that they may be required to come forward and speak to the complaint that they're making, so that it's not possible just to point a finger and then disappear into the woodwork.
Ryan?
I am going to make an amendment to this particular chapter that substantially says that if you bring forth a complaint and it can't be substantiated, you're subject to civil penalties. We have a lot of people who like to use this sort of stuff, take pot shots at public figures with groundless accusations, and the person has to stand and put up with the baloney and yet has no recourse. And so we'll put a little bit of teeth in this that you can make all the pot shots you want, but if you can't substantiate them, you're going to pay.
Okay.
I think it's only fair.
Running on?
Yes, and Susie, I mean, we actually, right now the committee is
is empowered to return complaints that are frivolous without investigating them, actually. I mean, that's a power the committee currently has. But there's no necessarily, there's not necessarily any teeth against those who would...
Let me ask Susie a question. Susie, what kind of measurement would you use to determine whether a complaint was frivolous?
And I did want to clarify, actually, the committee isn't empowered to do that, and this changes in the law will help them, and they would like your assistance in being allowed to return frivolous complaints and not have to waste time and energy on them. At the moment, the law pretty much requires us to deal with each complaint through the procedure. So we get a complaint, we have to say, is this within our jurisdiction or not? If it's within our jurisdiction, then it goes, you know, on to the next stage that we talked about on Saturday. But if we would like to be able to return frivolous complaints without having to convene an entire committee meeting together or subcommittee together. So currently, we aren't allowed to, and this bill would allow us to.
Okay, and Susie, to go further, does this section give you enough information to support your decision that it is, in fact, a frivolous case or not?
I think if you look at Section 46, we'll get further into that.
That's what I was looking at.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I guess, were you looking for specifics? So if somebody, the one I always use, if somebody writes in and says that, you know, files a complaint against Representative James and because they don't like the way Representative James drives her car, the committee still has to go through a procedure to say, to get together and look at it and say, do we have jurisdiction over this? This instead would say, you know, I'd be able to, or the staff person at the preliminary examination level would be able to say, no, this is ridiculous, bye-bye, and not convene a meeting, not spend a nickel.
Okay, but if they had made such a complaint, and it was, I would say that falls outside of your scope, but that particular example that you gave, but what if it was a complaint about something that did fall into the scope, and if the story was told properly that it would be an ethics violation, but they just don't provide any kind of support or proof that they're on target?
Then the committee has, and I believe always should, go forward and investigate those kinds of allegations for two reasons. One is because the public has a right to those kinds of actions, but also investigation often ends up saying no, and you are then protected as a legislator. And we are able to go through and say, no, there's no evidence to your allegation.
Do you understand what Representative Ryan was concerned about, is that people, if they can do that and cause some stress for somebody, sometimes they do that, they make what sounds to be a valid claim, ends up not having any validity at all, that there should be some penalty for doing that without cause?
Currently on our complaint form, though this would change. See, we like this change, that they would have to sign agreeing to this, but right now we can't require them to use our complaint form. However, there is a law on the books at the moment, 1156805 under the criminal code, that says that they cannot knowingly or intentionally initiate a false complaint. So today you are still protected by that. Anyone can tell you in this process, whether it's Human Rights Commission, all these kinds of things where complaints are filed against another person on the judicial side, it is difficult to prove knowingly or intentionally initiates a false complaint. But it is a standard and it exists, and so today it's there.
Okay, but you said they do or do not have to use that form?
Currently they do not have to. However, we try to get people to use this form. There's nothing in the code that requires them to do that. We like them to sign saying, I acknowledge, I read that. If they don't, then as a staff person, I call them and I say, we're not trying to tell the public that they that to be afraid to file complaints. That's not the goal of, I don't believe, the legislature. But we do want them to be informed, and so I do tell them I reference that law when they file a complaint if they haven't filed it on the proper form.
Could we, in this bill, make them require them to put their complaint on this particular form?
Well, I think that under
Section 45?
Yes, for Section 45, we are requiring that they sign the statement.
It's not a form, Representative James, but they do have to have a statement that the complainant has reason to believe that a violation of this chapter has occurred and describe any facts known to the complainant to support that belief. So we're mandating a certain statement and a signature, if not a form.
And the form has to be notarized in another section of the bill? I mean, it requires a notary.
Okay, I still don't quite have it because I don't understand the total legal implications. Is what we say here that they have reason to believe and that they have to and describes any facts known to support that belief. So that means they have reason to believe, but in any case they sign saying that they have reason to believe. If they didn't really have reason to believe and they made up the whole thing, then what is the course, besides filing a civil suit against them for
defamation of character
or something?
Susie?
That is your recourse.
Yep. So.
Or
the criminal, the Title 11 reference you just gave us as well.
And in response to Representative James' question, I think that you can include something in the bill that says the form. People will sign it and it will read this. I mean, there's no problem with.
I think we'll work on that. And the reason I'm even asking, we just had a bill in this committee on the Human Rights Commission, and one of the things is they don't have enough money to research all of the cases that they have, and so it's taking them a long time to get things done. And they gave us a percentage of 62% of the claims that come to them are unfounded. And I certainly support the idea is that the public has a right to do everything that they want, but somehow or other we have to balance that with the rights of the others. And I'm not sure that the 62% of the claims being not founded is reality. So, and I don't know what your rate of frivolousness would be. But in this case, I guess you don't have that information because you haven't been able to determine any were frivolous. Representative Ryan?
Madam Chairman, you know, the prosecutors are plea bargaining down murder, rape, burglaries, and so forth, and I don't think you're going to have much luck going to a prosecutor under Chapter 11 and Title 11 trying to get them to do anything about this complaint. You're wasting your time. So that is not an obvious answer. I think we have to be creative and come up with a penalty that will give the person who is accused as much satisfaction on being found innocent as the person who accuses them receives on them being found guilty. And usually the satisfaction for the person who is accused is a handsome monetary reward. So I will get together with legal and I'll work on that.
Okay, and if I might, Representative Ryan, it seems to me like that the purpose ought to be as a deterrent more than it is the penalty. And if there is the fear of a penalty out there sometimes, then that people won't do it. And I'd be more interested in the deterrent than I would the actual penalty.
Well, part of this DYFS backlog we have, they admit that about 50% of those are punitive. One parent wanting to get at the other, so files a complaint with DYFS. There's nothing to them, they're groundless. So that's quite rampant throughout the whole
government. Yeah, it is. Go ahead.
And I think, just before we move on, the Section 46 really is attempting to put in statute the way the process works now, but also that specifically enables committee staff to return complaints for being frivolous, for returning them for those that don't have credible information, so that even if you do have a spate of people filing complaints for the wrong reasons, they're getting nipped in the bud as quickly as possible, and it's not wasting the committee's time, you know?
That's one of the best parts of this bill.
I mean, it really, I think it is, too. I think it is, too. And the problem with the penalty is, I think, due process, if you're going to find a complainant guilty of frivolity, well, that's not going to be a staff decision.
the committee's going to have to meet and decide that it's frivolous. Whereas if you're just going to return the complaint without a penalty because it's frivolous, that's something the staffer can probably do a little more easily if the person is not being assessed a fine or sent to jail.
Yeah.
So there's probably a trade-off there.
We'll figure that out.
Okay. Section 47 of the bill, this is the existing language deals with dismissal of complaints if there's not justification for their consideration. But the committee would like to put in specifically that deliberations and vote on the dismissal order and decision are not open to the public or to the subject of the complaint. Again, that's to preserve the committee's ability to have a candid, full, and open debate about why to dismiss the complaint.
President Ryan?
If I am the subject of a complaint, I have every right in the world under the United States Constitution, the Alaska Constitution, everything else to know what the disposition of that complaint is.
And you will know what it is. This is something that they don't want you to be there while they're voting to dismiss it. If they decide not to dismiss the complaint and it goes to a hearing, obviously you'll have numerous due process protections in the process of the hearing. But this is before it's gone to that stage. And Susie, maybe you can speak to this a little more.
The people who are making this decision, I have every right to know who they are. They are, in effect, are confirming a complaint against me, which in effect makes them my complainant, and I have a right to know who my accusers are.
You, as a legislator, you not only know who they are, but you voted to confirm them before they've gone out of that panel, or not, but you've had an opportunity to do so.
But before we let Susie talk, I understand what Representative Ryan is talking about, is if there's a complaint against him, and the committee is going into a secret meeting where no one can be there, an executive session, and they're going to determine in that meeting that they're going to dismiss the case against Representative Ryan. This says that he can't know what happened in that meeting at all. He probably knows that it's going to be dismissed because he's going to get a comment on that. He wants to know how the people voted. He wants to know who supported not dropping it and who supported dropping it. And this says he doesn't have a right to know that. That's his concern.
Right.
I'm just trying to explain what his concern is. Susie, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Representative Ryan, or Representative James. In response to Representative Ryan's question, Representative James earlier made a statement that it's very difficult to get people to serve on the Ethics Committee. I can tell you, if votes have to be recorded, I don't think any of you will ever want to serve on the committee, because when you like your bill to get passed through somebody's committee that you have been recorded as voting, yes, you found probable cause that there was evidence of violation of the code. You know, I mean, you're in this political arena, and the committee talked about this at great length. It was not the public members who were concerned about it. They are very bold public members and willing to put their names on the line. It's that to protect their representatives and senators who are willing to serve with them on the committee, they felt very strongly that votes should not be recorded in public.
Okay, Representative Sanders?
Yeah, Ben, are there any provisions in here for an appeal if the staff determines this to be frivolous or a complaint to be frivolous?
Representative Sanders, through the chair, at this point, I don't see the possibility for appeal in the proposed language and back in Section 46. And so the one who would suffer there would be the complainant. You know, as the subject, that's a higher level of protection for you. I mean, if staff can decide that it's frivolous and the complainant can't do anything when they decide that, that's one more level of protection for all of us covered by the code. The one who suffers is the complainant who says, but it's not frivolous. Where else do they go? For the court of public opinion? It's an interesting question. And Susie, maybe you can address that, because I don't know how we streamline the process and try to prevent frivolity if we don't enable staff to make that call about what is frivolous or not.
I never thought I'd be working on something to prevent frivolity. In response to that, I and Representative Sanders, I do believe that if someone wrote to the chair of the committee and said this complaint was dismissed by a staff person, I object, that the chair would probably immediately take it up. But in fact, there's nothing here that either says that can happen or can't happen. But I do understand your question.
Yeah, let's go on.
Okay.
One more thing, Representative Ryan.
The point I want to emphasize, that we decry in the newspaper editorials, in the pulpit, ourselves when we're being pompous and speaking in public. A lack of responsibility on the part of everybody in society today. Nobody's responsible for anything. Women are going out and having children without the benefit of marriage, and society has to pay for them and so forth. And yet in this bill, we're allowing people to be irresponsible. They can have a vote, and it's going to be in secret, and we're not going to tell anybody what we did. We're going to nail you, but you're not going to know who nailed you.
Well,
I object to that. If you're going to vote anything about me, I want to be privy, and I want to see what that vote's about, because my character, my reputation is on the line, and I want to know who is against me and who's for me. And I think I have that right under the system of English common law.
Yeah, you. In fact, as Representative Ryan, you may have that right. I don't know if they're talking about me, if I want the world to know. I just assume not anyone else know about it, and let them do it in secret, providing and worry about it. But that's my personal opinion. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, just the decision they make has to be one that is to your liking, probably, here, though.
Nope.
I mean, if they decide not to dismiss the complaint and to proceed to formal charges, you're not going to know who voted on it, but you're probably going to find out in the course of the next stage of the hearing, unless that person flip-flops. I mean, it will become apparent to you, I would think, as the proceedings unfold. This is at an early stage, and the likely result of these secret deliberations is going to be dismissals of complaints. That is the likely result of these early deliberations. Things that look like they're heading towards formal charges are not going to end up having a dismissal hearing, because that's not going to be the recommendation of staff, because there's a likely violation of the chapter.
Ben Brown, if you are going to accuse me of something that hurts my reputation, it hurts me as a man, I want you to look me in the eye and tell me.
Fair enough.
Go ahead.
On to Section 48. This deals with the committee's authority to revisit charges that they thought they had dismissed or disposed of through coming to an agreement for corrective action with the subject of a complaint. This enables the committee to go back to the subject and say, but you didn't do what we agreed you would do, and therefore we're going to bring the charges back as a means of having a stick and saying, you know, it's a corrective action and we really want you to take it. The committee feels like the current code doesn't provide them with that ability, and it creates a loophole where you can agree to a corrective action and then not take it, and you're off the hook. Probably not the intent of the legislature when it passed the ethics code originally. Did I get that, Susie?
Yes, it empowers the legislature to enforce its sanctions and corrective actions. I mean, remember, we're a body of the legislature, so it's empowering the legislature, and it provides the committee a route to do that.
Okay, let's go on.
Section 49 refers back to Section 48H, referring to G here, that the committee decides to charge a person. It's just a conforming reference to the procedure there.
Okay, go on.
When there's not compliance. Section 50, almost halfway through, deals with the discovery procedures that apply to proceedings under the ethics code. This enables, but the reference to the rules of civil procedure is still there, but it also allows the committee to adopt discovery procedures that enable earlier discovery by the subject to the benefit of that person, and also that allows the committee to restrict the release of information. And this final language came from Senator Donnelly, I believe, to prevent uneven gag orders, basically. So if the committee wants to tell the subject that he or she can't speak about things that come up in the course of discovery, they have to impose the same restrictions on the complainant. And unless both agree, the gag order basically can't be enforced. This isn't something, the latter part didn't come from the Ethics Committee, but I don't think it's something the committee has a strong objection to, if I'm not mistaken, Susie.
If I can respond to that, individual members of the committee do have a problem with it because they have absolutely no control over the complainant. So there's the two things. One, the complainant does not receive discovery information, period. It's not accessible to them. And so it's an odd piece of language, and we don't have any control over it. Let me tell you that the restrictions on discovery are to protect the legislator. I know this sounds odd, but complaints are often filed or can be filed against more than one legislator in a complaint, and a case may involve more than one legislator. And it's not okay for one legislator to release everything at the expense of another one or an employee involved. So think of it in those terms.
Representative Ryan?
Madam Chairman, I have a little problem that I've had for quite a while. Last year, there was a complaint brought before the body about Representative Sanders, and I can't say that I agree with that determination that was made by the committee, but I did notice they spent an awful lot of money substantiating whatever process they went through. And anything that the person about whom the complaint was made had to do in their defense had to be out of pocket. And I don't see that that at all is fair, that if a complaint were made about me and I had to hire an attorney or I had to get an investigator for discovery and all this kind of stuff, that because somebody made a complaint, I have to reach in my pocket and to spend that when the committee can take public funds and use whatever it seems to use to substantiate its form of the complaint. So it seems to be a basic unfairness here.
Yeah, well, let me say that I don't think that this
$24,000 a year
that we're talking here does that. I think if I understand this one here, we're talking about when discovery, when there is discovery, that the discovery is shared with the subject of the earlier on to permit the person who's the subject to engage in discovery at an earlier stage of the proceeding. Does that mean that they're going to be able to get discovery on their own early on and present it to the committee, or does that mean that they get to be sharing the information of the discovery that the committee has found? Would you explain that to me?
Susie, go right ahead.
You see above that it says the committee may adopt procedures that. So you're empowering your committee to adopt procedures that say, okay, we want to be able to share discovery earlier. There are references in here as to when discovery can be allowed, and the committee at times has felt like they would be happy to provide discovery, but the proceedings wouldn't allow it. So that's what we're doing in this section.
Well, and I certainly understand that, because it seems to me like that when you're pursuing a case like this, that maybe some of the first discovery that you get, which appears to be one way, is really not that way. And so there would be an opportunity for the subject of the complaint to rebut earlier. I don't know if that's the case and how this procedure works, but it seems to me like, what other reason would you want the person who is the subject of the complaint to have privileged information of the discovery until you got all your discovery? What? Tell me how that works now.
I think in a logical manner, the only reason you would want to avoid providing discovery, I'm a little hesitant to make such a far-reaching statement, but is if you have incomplete information. So if you find you've deposed someone and you get a reference to something, and perhaps you would like to, you know, then find out what that reference is and follow it up, but I mean, generally, I think that's about the only time where you have some fiery information that's incomplete.
Okay, but now do you share, this says permit a person who is subject of a complaint to engage in discovery at an earlier stage of the proceedings, and what does the complainant, what kind of an opportunity does the complainant have to be engaged in discovery?
The complainant is not involved in the discovery process.
Do they have knowledge of the discovery as it proceeds?
When a complainant files a complaint, this is what they get. They file the complaint, they get a letter saying, thank you, we've received your complaint. At the point at which there's a scope of, if the committee finds they have jurisdiction, they adopt a resolution outlining the scope of investigation, and the complainant gets a copy of that. The complainant gets interviewed. During the, if the committee goes to investigation, the committee the complainant gets interviewed during the investigation. Many, many times the complainant has no firsthand knowledge, so there's not an in-depth interview. And then the complainant gets a copy of the decision at the end of the deliberation.
So that's all the... So the... I don't understand the conversation then that we had about this paragraph, which was talking about having a gag order on the subject as well as the complainant.
And I agree, Representative James, and I mean, on a personal, I'm not speaking on behalf of the committee, but on a personal note, I would recommend deleting that section because it is confusing and it does lead, I believe, if I was the subject of a complaint, all of a sudden I'd be concerned, I'd be reading this and think, oh my God, the complainant gets discovery?
Well, that's one of those perhaps unintended consequences. I think what Senator Donnelly wanted to accomplish here is to prevent subjects of complaints from being gagged by the committee when complainants, even though they're not involved in a discovery process, are in fact running around to the media saying, I know so-and-so did this, the committee's investigating it right now. It's an almost impossible problem to try to solve, hence the rather clumsy effort to do so that's in this language here. But, I mean, it's a worthy goal that he had. Susie's right, it's not very enforceable. I mean, there's just next to nothing the Ethics Committee is ever going to be able to do to control complainants' behavior. I mean, that's...
Go on. I made myself a note to talk to Donnelly about this.
Okay. I mean, if there's some other way to do it, we should try, but... Section 51...
Brian, you have questions?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Susie said that when someone is being deposed, a deposition, as you know, is expensive. If the investigation of the committee is taking depositions, do I have to hire an attorney and have them take depositions to protect myself? And if so, who bears the cost of that? I don't certainly want to reach in my pocket at $24,000 a year from this legislature and start paying attorneys to depose people. And fair is fair. Now, if the committee wants to go to all this investigative so forth, I think we should add a fiscal note that allows the person subject to the complaint to have the same investigative process the committee has to protect themselves, and the state will pick up the ticket. I think it's only fair.
If exonerated.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you don't do anything, if you don't screw up, you don't have to worry about this, hopefully. Susie, would you like to respond to that?
If I may, one more thing. We provide a public defender for people who don't get exonerated. And yet, we pay a tremendous amount of money every year paying for these people's defense. Now, as an elected official, I'm not entitled to the same protection as people who commit crimes.
You get $24,000 a year.
Oh, yeah. Rich.
Susie, you have any response to that issue?
Most of the cases, you would find are resolved long before we get to anything even that looks and sounds like a deposition.
That's kind of what I thought. Just because you're questioning people doesn't mean that you are, or getting evidence doesn't mean that you're doing depositions of these people.
No, and those stages, in our series of stages, you will see that when we get to the formal charges in a public hearing, and as you recall, the first one that this, under the new law, the committee had with Senator Jacko. That level of involvement in a quasi-judicial setting. Yes, we're at depositions at that point, but most of the cases are resolved in a different manner under corrective actions. And
okay, well, we'll go on.
Section 51. This deals with the confidentiality of proceedings before the Ethics Committee before the stage of probable cause has been reached. This is existing language for the most part until we get to the top of page 32. It is of note because we duplicate some of the language in the Executive Branch Ethics Code, the part about transmission of information about criminal wrongdoing or violations of the Campaign Finance Act. It's kind of a streamlined mechanism, so the committee finds something that's really criminal or that it's blatantly inconsistent with the way campaigns are supposed to be financed, it has to just transfer that information over to the appropriate jurisdictional authority, though it can continue, of course, with its own ethics investigation. The change at the top of page 32 specifies that legislators who aren't members of the committee can't just decide to go sit in on deliberations before the probable cause stage has been reached. And again, that is to address the problem that, that Susie spoke of a little while ago. If the legislative members of the committee didn't have some level of protection from their peers as they deliberated with the public members who comprise the majority of the subcommittees, the House and Senate subcommittees, it would be next to impossible to find someone to want to serve on the Ethics Committee, I would think. Someone who didn't care about burning bridges, perhaps.
Representative Berkowitz?
I spent a lot of time in courtrooms looking at people and accusing them of crimes. The Sixth Amendment is pretty clear to me that you should have the right to confront your accusers.
These aren't your accusers, though. The Ethics Committee isn't your accuser. And I also don't know in common law if there's much precedent for having the opportunity to confirm the person who's hearing your case, who's also a member of the same body you're a member of. I think there are a lot of things here that are just always going to be different. This is not really a judicial creature. It's a committee of the legislature.
Subsequent to the determination of probable cause, is the subject entitled to be present at all hearings?
I don't think at all. Susie, go ahead and explain to us the subject's rights after probable cause has been established.
First, let me just remind you that we're at the point where the committee is serving as the jury, and having the subject in the jury room is something inconceivable to almost anyone involved in the process. During the deliberation, when the jury goes out and goes into their room on the side, and that's what's happening, is that they're acting in it in their jury capacity. Otherwise, the subject of a complaint is told that they have access to the committee, but not during deliberations, and they may request it at any time. And we have had subjects come in and meet with the committee, subjects write to the committee, subjects ask me to say something to the committee. They have access.
But subsequent to the determination of probable cause, I just want to ensure that the subject of the investigation is entitled to be present at all fact-finding stages of the proceedings.
As long as you are not including deliberations.